You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
All right, guys, super excited to dive into this week's episode. We are getting the opportunity. We've actually invited Paula Pant from AffordAnything.com back on the show. There's multiple reasons that I'm excited about this. One, because Paula is just a wonderful person. Two, she is an expert in so many different areas, and in particular, real estate. We interviewed her last year, and when I look at her journey, I wouldn't say that she dived into real estate. It was almost kind of from an accidental perspective. An opportunity opened up, and she went for it. But from there, she didn't just let it go by. She actually looked for what worked really well, and she's cultivated this expertise by actually doing the work. And the reason I say this is that my co-host Brad is anything but a real estate expert. In fact, he has quite publicly shared his experience of total abject failure when it comes to rental real estates, and it involves a speculative property in North Carolina that cost him quite literally close to $100,000. This horrific experience so jaded him against the real estate industry just in general that he just kind of put a wall up around it. And it's only as a result of this podcast and this community and exposing himself to better information as he kind of come full circle, said, you know what, I think I want to go back to the drawing board, learn everything that I didn't take the time to learn the first time, and see what it looks like to go about learning and investing in real estate as a business model. There was no one in our minds that would be better suited to this to really help him go through this learning curve than Paula Pant. For our audience, she actually has a real estate course, and she has a free ebook by the title of 7 Expensive Rental Property Mistakes to Avoid. I think Brad has made 8 of those 7. And anyways, what we're hoping to do today with this conversation is basically create a framework around getting involved in real estate, how to think about it, what opportunities are out there so you can find something that works for you. Really excited about this conversation. And to help me with this, I have my co-host Brad here with me today. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, Jonathan, I am doing quite well. And yeah, it is just a marvelous opportunity to have friends like Paula Pant, who you can rely on for just an unbelievable wealth of knowledge. And yeah, I'm just so happy for myself, selfishly, but for the community to be able to bounce these questions off her. Because frankly, so many people out there are exactly like me, who you want to invest in real estate, but you have all these questions. You're nervous, you're scared to get started. And I really hope this particular episode can cut through that noise. So Paula, with that, welcome back to the Choose It By podcast.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me here. I'm very excited to chat with you.
So Brad, I just super in passing tried to set up your story for you, but I don't think there's anybody better to tell your story than yourself. So why don't I go ahead and send this back to you? How does a host of a personal finance podcast fail so badly at what for many people would be considered a pillar of financial independence?
Well, thank you, Jonathan. I appreciate it. But yeah, I mean, this was without question the biggest financial mistake of my life. I think in a lot of other ways, I've gotten it right. The savings rate, the investing in low-cost index funds, and all the pillars. But man, did we mess up with real estate. When I was, I think, 26 years old in 2005, right at the height of the speculative bubble, we saw these quote-unquote investments in these golf course, country club type properties down in North Carolina and places like that. And my wife and I, my girlfriend and I at that time, we went down and visited this one place in Wallace, North Carolina called River Landing. And this place is gorgeous. They were selling these lots for under $100,000 and the houses were like $400,000 or $500,000. It seemed like this great opportunity for what, frankly? I don't know at this point, but like I was 26 years old and I'm seeing these things go up in price. So, I mean, truly a speculative bubble. This was people buying these lots. There were hundreds of them and very few people had houses up for sale, but man, these lots were turning over quickly. We actually had the unlucky fortune of selling one of these things, reselling them for a higher price just 6 months down the road. And we thought, man, we are geniuses. This couldn't be easier. So what did we do? We bought more of them. And we went into partnership with family and friends. Talk about doubling down on the stupidity here. And what happens? But the absolute crash of the market. And these things plummeted 50, 60, 70 plus percent in value. I mean, honestly, we are still paying for one or two of them today. It was truly, you said six figures, Jonathan. I would say it's well north. Well, certainly when compounded, it's many times that. I mean, I don't even want to do the math just because we're talking, I mean, almost 15 years at this point, right? So this is about as bad as it can possibly get. So long story short, this scarred me. But this at its heart was my own stupidity. This wasn't investing. This was speculation. But then I, as a listener of Afford Anything and Bigger Pockets and Chad Carson's podcast, I have learned a lot of things. I've learned about the 1% rule and actually investing and looking at real estate as a business. So I think that kind of brings me to this point where I want to move forward intelligently, but there are questions that I have. And Paula, I think that's where we bring you in.
First of all, thank you for sharing that story. And I'm sorry that you went through that. Although, if there is a silver lining, it's that that lesson, while painful, was expensive tuition in the school of how to distinguish investing from speculating. I often say that appreciation is speculation, which kind of rhymes, so I like it. But what I mean by that is that if you are making a decision based purely on the assumption that an asset will rise in value over time, and there is no other value that is inherent to that asset other than your speculation of its future value, well, then that is speculation. That is true speculation because that asset doesn't have any type of income stream. So when you talk about bare land, which is what you were investing in, for most plots of bare land, the only way to make money on that is through appreciation, which is speculation. Now, there are some plots of bare land that might be forested and you can, you know, in an environmentally responsible way, thin the trees and make some, produce some income from that. You know, there are some parcels of bare land that have income producing opportunities, but for the most part, bare land is speculation.
Now, Paul, I'd love for you to do a little compare and contrast here with your first property and why you got excited about your first deal. Cause it was not an empty lot.
Correct. So my first property, well, let me back up and say that there is a difference between the result or the outcome and the decision-making process and the soundness of the decision-making process that got you there. So when I bought my first property, Brad, very much like you, I had no idea what I was doing. For me, it happened to work out, but I didn't, at the time that I bought my first property, which was a triplex, I didn't understand the fundamentals. I didn't understand how to calculate the cap rate, how to calculate the cash on cash return. I didn't understand how to critically evaluate between formulas such that I had judgment over what formulas I prioritized over others and why. I didn't know any of that. I simply bought a property on the blind assumption that, well, quote unquote, if the rent pays for the mortgage, then I'll be fine, right? Which is unfortunately how a lot of rental property investors approach investing. Now, in my case, it happened to work out. But again, there's a huge difference between the decision-making process that gets you to an end result versus the end result itself. So for example, if you run a red light, you don't get a ticket, you don't get into an accident, and you end up reaching your destination faster, well, the result was positive, but does that mean that running the red light is a good idea? Absolutely not. And that was very much how my first property purchase was. It happened to work out, but it was after I bought that first property that I realized it easily could have gone the other way because I didn't know what I was doing. And it was after that first property that I then deep dived into learning what I was doing so that the second, third, fourth, fifth property could be purchased with a much deeper understanding of the fundamentals. And Brad, that's exactly what you're doing now. So I applaud you for that.
Well, thank you, Paul. And certainly as you're describing that, I'm thinking about Annie Duke's book, Thinking in Bets. And she describes a process called resulting, which is exactly that. It's not looking at the factors that went into the decision-making process, but just looking at the result and then determining was that a good or bad decision. And that's kind of silly when you think about it. It should be based on the input. So with your first deal, was it just simply based on does this cover the mortgage? Like, was that your decision-making process?
More or less. I mean, with my first deal, I was a renter in a triplex across the street, and I didn't know how to apply any formulas. So I simply did some back of the envelope math. I knew what the rent on my own unit was, and I knew what the rent in the other two units within that building were. You can go on Zillow and find out the price at which the owner bought the property. So I tallied up the rent that the landlord was collecting for the triplex that I was living in. And then I compared that to what he purchased the property for by looking at that information on Zillow. And then I calculated what the mortgage was. And I saw that he was basically breaking even, that the rent covered the mortgage. And intuitively, I knew that that probably meant that he was losing money because, of course, there's more than just a mortgage payment. There's repairs, there's maintenance, there's vacancies. But I didn't actually know how to calculate that. And so when I saw a triplex that was for sale and I saw that the mortgage was significantly lower than the rent that I could collect, I basically intuited that as long as the gap or the spread was between that rent and mortgage was wide enough, that would give me enough cushion. But that, in hindsight, is an absolutely terrible way to make a decision. And just as Annie Duke talks about resulting, you know, don't let the fact that the result happened to be positive in any way fool you into thinking that that was a good decision. It was not.
So what I'd like to do is actually just take a half step back and talk about real estate as an investment vehicle, and specifically to do it in the context of a compare and contrast. Because anybody that has achieved levels of wealth, I think we're all kind of limited to these three categories. We either do it through our investments, so the stock market, et cetera. We do it through entrepreneurship, starting a business, or we do it in real estate, right? Maybe there's something else that I'm not missing, but I feel like those three, that's pretty comprehensive for the vast majority of individuals. And I'm curious, in your mind, where does real estate stack up against those other two lanes, those other two vehicles?
Well, so when we talk about real estate, we're talking about a fairly broad umbrella. Talking about real estate is almost like talking about entrepreneurship or talking about careers, because under the umbrella of real estate, you have everything ranging from flipping houses to buy and hold rental properties to purchasing tax liens to speculating on bare land. You have this to mobile home park investing. I mean, you have this massive universe of niches and strategies. And when I say niches and strategies, this is what I mean. So your niche might be mobile home parks. Your niche might be commercial properties, such as office buildings or warehouses. Your niche might be residential properties, which are defined as properties with four or fewer units. Any of those could be niches that you choose to focus on. In addition to that, you also have strategies. So your strategy might be long-term buy and hold. Your strategy might be flipping. There are a large number of different strategies. And depending on that combination of niche and strategy that you select under this big umbrella universe of real estate, your experience is going to be different. Your projected returns are going to be different. And the level of involvement that you will have is going to be different. So in terms of how active is it going to be versus how passive is it going to be, that very largely depends on what niche and what strategy you select. Somebody who flips houses and who has a strategy of purchasing one house per month is certainly going to be much more actively involved than somebody who is a long-term buy and hold investor with a strategy of purchasing one house every year or one house every 2 years.
Paula, how much research did you put into selecting your own personal niche? Obviously, you're describing this initial triplex, and I mean, that could have just led you down that road and not thinking critically, just I'm a residential investor, right? But I know you're a deep thinker, so you're not pot committed at that point. You, I'm certain, went into a ton of research on all these different niches, and I'd love to hear that process and how you eventually came to your conclusion of how to move forward with true real estate investing.
Sure, absolutely. Well, first of all, my niche is residential long-term buy and hold, but I do not in any way mean to imply that residential is better or worse than any other niche. What I eventually came to, I looked at residential, so four or fewer units. I looked at apartment complexes. I looked at renting commercial space to businesses. And there are a lot of advantages to going into those fields. If you have a triple net lease to a business, meaning that that business takes care of the repairs, the maintenance, they essentially take care of a lot of things in that commercial world that residential property owners are typically expected to take care of when they are renting a residential property out to tenants. There are certainly big, big advantages to being in the commercial space or to being in the mobile home park space. What I eventually came to was a decision that it is more important to be an expert in a narrow field than it is to find the best field. My competitive advantage comes from mastery in a given arena rather than from picking the best or quote unquote best arena. And so what the choice that I came to early on was that I would have the best opportunity for mastery in the residential buy and hold rental property arena for a couple of reasons. Number one, financing for residential properties is easier to obtain, particularly at the beginner levels, than financing for commercial properties. Number two, the opportunities, the volume of deals and deal flow is much higher for residential properties. There are more residential homes than there are warehouses or mobile home parks or commercial spaces or apartment complexes, major apartment complexes. So that deal flow and the opportunity to find those undervalued gems existed in a much greater degree in the residential world. And again, I don't mean to imply that it's better or worse. This was simply my thinking when I decided to choose this as my own area of specialty. So deal flow, financing, and simply the fact that it was probably also in part, to be honest, a consequence of my first deal being in that world and therefore, myself going through the learning curve on that first deal, such that once I went through that learning curve, I decided it would be better to build upon the foundation that I had already established rather than switch gears and try to find an entirely different arena. So the analogy that I might use is if you already have spent a good amount of time getting really skilled at Italian cooking at a professional level, then to switch gears and go over into Thai cooking, there are still basic skill sets that are transferable, but there's going to be a learning curve. So is it worth it to go through that second learning curve?
Yeah, I like that. And, it actually reminds me of a conversation I was having with a fellow. He was basically making the case, he has 40 properties here in the Richmond area, and he was making the case that even if your first deal isn't like the most amazing, even if you're like breaking even or barely going positive, at least you just got started. And he was making the case that you're just aging into your skill set. But I think even more than that, it goes to what you're talking about having broken through that learning curve. Just by doing something, now you know what works to some varying degree, but also maybe even more importantly, what doesn't work. And if you're going to fail, if you can fail small and fail forward into your next better deal, then that's the best case scenario. And in Brad's case, he belly flopped, right? he knocked himself out of the game altogether. So there's something to be said for as you're looking through the opportunities that are out there, instead of going all in on one risky hand, if you can create a scenario where even if you fail, you're not failing badly and you can take that into the next opportunity, the next one. I think that even is something that you mentioned to us when we interviewed you before. It was basically along the lines of just get started, right? Mm-hmm. You got to get in the game.
Absolutely. The only way to get ahead is to get started. What I've seen for a lot of investors or aspiring investors is that the fear that keeps them from going into that first deal can delay their progress by years. Or sometimes in the worst case scenario, it delays their progress to never. And a decade later, they look back and say, oh, I regret that I didn't invest a decade ago, right? So buying that first property, that's the property that allows you to overcome your fear of buying properties or your fear of going into this very tangible, very visceral six-figure investment. It's funny if you think about it. People have more fear about spending $150,000 on a single family home than they do about putting $150,000 into a broad market index fund. It's the same amount of money. We'll assume in this example that you're doing an all cash deal. It's the same amount of money, but the the fact that homes are so tangible, so visceral, and in that regard, so emotional, I think can trigger a lot of fear in a way that index fund investing cannot. And also the fact that there are so many naysayers in the real estate investing world, you know, people who have either never been involved in it or have only heard anecdotal experiences from their cousin Billy or their uncle Bob. And so they'll say, oh, I'm not interested in being a slumlord. You know, and when we get that type of negative feedback, you know, and we get that to a much greater degree in the world of real estate than we do in the world of 401k investing, it can stop people in their tracks. And so I strongly encourage anybody who wants to go into rental property investing or real estate investing generally to do their first deal. And of course, do it with some degree of education behind you. Do it with some degree of information that's supporting you. Don't do what both Brad and I did, which was jump in blind and hope it worked out. Because Brad, you and I both, we both had the same flawed decision-making process going in. Yours happened to not work out. Mine happened to work out. But our thought process was the same.
Brad's so, like, can I switch sides?
Please. Paul, let's talk about maybe the right way to approach this mentally and decision-making wise. So you mentioned a couple times formulas you prioritize. I'm assuming that's how someone maybe gets started even trying to take action, because that's what we're talking about here, right? You're saying take action, don't waste years based on fear, but they have to get started somehow and they're not just going to close their eyes and buy a property just to buy a property. How would someone start to winnow the field of potential single family rentals? Like, where is step one?
So a couple of things. Now, first of all, if you live in a high cost of living area, then you are unlikely to find good rental property deals in that location. It is possible, but it's more needle in a haystack. It's like trying to find a spouse on Tinder. You know, it's just frustrating.
They're
and at
there.
A certain point, you're just going to give up. So it's possible, but you will have an easier time trying to find a good deal in an area where the price to rent ratio is landlord friendly. Now, when I say price to rent ratio, that is, as the name implies, it is the price divided by the annual rent. So for example, if a home costs $300,000, it rents for $1,500 a month, meaning $18,000 per year at full occupancy, then the price to rent ratio is 300,000 divided by 18,000, which would be 16.6. I did that math before we started recording.
I was going to say, just had that totally ready to go.
And so in cities in which the price to rent ratio is 10 or under, those are pretty landlord friendly cities. In cities where the price to rent ratio is, you know, maybe 12, 13, 14 or over, you might have a slightly harder time finding those good deals. So the first thing that I would do is just start looking at different cities. And if you live in a high cost of living area, start looking at cities where you, ideally, where you might already have some type of connection. If your Aunt Sally lives in Kansas City or Dayton, Ohio or Birmingham or Huntsville or Cincinnati, start there. It's not necessarily a city that you would need to travel to often, but it's a city that you, at a minimum, once you get that property under contract, you will want to go out there to take a look at it. So I would recommend choosing a city that has access to an airport or that is relatively close to an airport so that you can go out there, you know, once you have a property under contract. But anyway, find a city where the price to rent ratios are very landlord friendly. That's step one. And then step two is, once you then find that city, narrow it down to particular neighborhoods. And when you're looking at neighborhoods, neighborhoods are considered class A, B, C, or D. A class A neighborhood is where you're going to find Lululemon, Panera Bread, Orange Theory Fitness, Brio Tuscan Grill. That's where you're going to find those type of establishments that cater to, frankly, rich people. Because if you have the money to spend $10 on a kale and strawberry salad, then you're rich. And so class A neighborhoods are typically not going to be neighborhoods where you're going to find the best deals. But if you think of rental property investing similar to stock investing, in that there's a risk reward continuum, right? Where if risk increases, potential reward increases. And if risk decreases, then the potential reward also decreases. So class A neighborhoods, you might have a hard time finding good rental properties there. But if you do, and you are more likely to in cities with landlord-friendly price to rent ratios, then those class A neighborhoods, you will have the lowest risk also the lowest potential return. But if that's your strategy, then that's perfectly fine. It is just like index fund investing or bond investing. It is totally okay to decide that you want to have a portion of your portfolio that is asset allocated to lower risk, lower return. So that's what you'll find in a Class A neighborhood. A Class B neighborhood is like, you know, the Simpsons, like Homer and Marge Simpson and Bart and Lisa and Maggie. Yeah. They live in a Class B neighborhood. It's not a Panera Bread area, like a Panaria, but...
Well, what do we got? We got KFC? I mean, what's going on in this neighborhood?
So, yeah, Class B neighborhoods. Yeah, you might have some KFC, some Red Lobster. You'll have not the fancy malls, but the, like, you know, the mall that's still anchored by a Sears because they still exist. Or Big Lots or, you know, some TJ Maxx's. You know, you'll see those in Class B neighborhoods. Class C neighborhoods, you typically see a lot of independently owned businesses. You will see air conditioning units with cages around them. I posted a video of this to my Instagram stories recently. I've got this on one of my rental properties. So I put a cage around the AC unit because if I don't, then there's a high likelihood that somebody is going to steal the scrap copper out of it. That is what you tend to find in Class C neighborhoods.
What's
you might
left
find,
for Class D? Is like demolition zone?
Yeah, Class D. Class D are places that you would not feel safe going in broad daylight. They're places, put it this way, Class A, you would love to live there. Class B, nice frugal neighborhood, you wouldn't mind living there. Class C, you know, if you're scrappy or if you're a grad student or if you've recently immigrated to the United States, yeah, you'd live in a Class C neighborhood. It's maybe a slightly sketchy, but you might still find yourself living there. Class D neighborhoods, you would rather just sleep in your car. So I tell people to avoid Class D neighborhoods. Like those are the places that, unless you are a highly experienced investor, those are the places that you don't want to touch. Many real estate investors refer to Class D neighborhoods as war zones. And when I first heard that, I thought that that was a little bit offensive. Like there are genuine war zones out there. How can you refer to a neighborhood as a war zone? But having then gone into certain Class D neighborhoods, I understand why that terminology exists. So I would avoid Class D neighborhoods, but Class C, you know, Class C neighborhoods are, I mean, they're places where I would be willing to live. I would want to cage the AC. I might want to maybe have those little bars over the windows, but I'd still live there.
So I'm thinking about Richmond, Virginia, where Jonathan and I live. I guess we live in, as you're describing it, a Class A area. There are undoubtedly areas that will fit that landlord-friendly 10 or under price to rent ratio. But those, as I'm seeing it in my mind's eye, are probably Class C, maybe even into D. So I'm not sure that that would necessarily fit on your scale of landlord friendly, even though it's under that 10. But I'm assuming, and this is a big assumption, so bear with me here, but the cities that you consider in Alabama and Tennessee and places like that, that fit your requirements, are those maybe even potentially Class B that fit into mm-hmm. your price to rent of under 10? Am I thinking about this right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. What I want to distinguish here when we talk about the risk-reward continuum or the risk-reward spectrum is you will have higher potential returns, but also higher risk in a Class C neighborhood. You will have lower risk and also lower potential returns in a Class A neighborhood. So take that framework and then apply it to any city that you're looking at. And what you might find is that in Richmond, Virginia, that city is so, I'm assuming, so expensive, so high cost of living, that the only place where you have price to rent ratios that even are a stone's throw of being landlord friendly might be in a Class C area, or it might be in an area in which the risk profile of that neighborhood is not congruous with the risk profile that you yourself are looking for. So what I would do first and foremost is decide what type of risk profile you yourself are looking for. Because if you are looking for a Class A or Class B risk profile, and I think that that's a great place to start, particularly as a beginner, then that means that you're going to want to invest in cities in which the price to rent ratios are such that you could find landlord-friendly properties in Class A or Class B neighborhoods. And so that is unlikely to be Richmond, Virginia, based on what you've told me.
So to clarify, basically, if you want a hotter neighborhood, a ritzier neighborhood, you need to be willing to move farther away from your coastal cities and vice versa. And you just have to kind of pair what sort of risk you're willing to accept with the type of property that you want to obtain.
Yeah, exactly. So I would start with the self-knowledge question of what type of risk profile am I looking for? And if you decide that that's class A or class B, then that means that you're going to have to invest in cities in which you are more likely to find landlord-friendly properties in class A neighborhoods or in class B neighborhoods.
Paula, we're talking about this price-to-rent ratio, and I'm just doing the back-of-the-envelope math here. As compared to the 1% rule, which I've heard talked about on your show and Bigger Pockets and places like that, as I'm seeing it, and I want you to describe the 1% rule, certainly, but that would fit the requirement. So just doing the math, the 1% rule would get us to a price-to-rent of 8.3. So
exactly.
Awesome. Okay, good. So we're doing the same math, which is great. So I would love for you to explain that. And is that a good shorthand when someone is mentally approaching a single family rental?
Yes, absolutely. So the 1% rule is a guideline for sorting through properties. It's a sorting mechanism as you're looking at a wide variety of potential deals that you might be interested in investing in. And the 1% rule states that the gross monthly rent of a property should be at least 1% of its purchase price. So in other words, for every $100,000 worth of home, that property should rent for at least $1,000 per month. A $200,000 home should rent for $2,000 a month. $300,000 home should rent for $3,000 a month. Now, as Brad, exactly as you pointed out, when we take that framework and we apply it to price-to-rent ratio, if you have a $100,000 home divided by annual rent of $12,000, because it rents for $1,000 a month, which is $12,000 a year at full occupancy, that gives a price-to-rent ratio of 8.3. And so when we first start looking at cities broadly, like if we're trying to decide if we're interested in investing in Kansas City or Lincoln, Nebraska or Las Vegas, Nevada or Tulsa, Oklahoma, when we're looking for a shorthand as we're searching through different cities, it can be useful to just look at a bunch of price-to-rent ratios and say, hey, if I were to just throw a dart at this list of cities, am I broadly seeing houses that have price-to-rent ratios that are under 10-ish, you know, maybe under 11 or under 12? Like, are they in the right ballpark? You know, we don't want cities where price-to-rent ratios are 15 to 20 to 25 even. Like, that's just out of league. Once you find a city in which, broadly speaking, those price-to-rent ratios are in the right ballpark, all right, that's when you've narrowed down your search to a particular city or a particular handful of cities. So let's say that you've done that and you've narrowed your search to Huntsville, Alabama. Then the next step is to start, now that you've picked that city, you then want to start looking at particular neighborhoods inside of that city and asking yourself the question, is there a sufficient volume of homes within this neighborhood that meet the 1% rule? And that 1% rule is, as I described, would the gross monthly rent be at least 1% of the purchase price of the property? Which means, if you apply that to the price-to-rent ratio, that that house has a price-to-rent ratio of 8.3 or less.
You know, what's interesting about this is, although I personally do not own any rental properties, I am now in the process of selling my first home. And the 1% rule was actually something that I looked at when I was trying to decide whether or not to become a de facto landlord by virtue of now having a home that I'm no longer in or renting and renting it out versus like, hey, I want to get a rental property. So basically, are you turning a home that you lived in into a rental property, or are you going out and you're finding a great rental property? And I suspected, because I had this 1% rule in mind, that my home was a great family home. It was a great home for my family. It was not an optimal rental property. So my home would be valued roughly right around $300,000. And I looked at that neighborhood and I said, is this a neighborhood that's going to give me reliably $3,000 a month in rent? And clearly it wasn't. That's not going to happen. And so, you know, you'd have to scale that down. And there's certainly other factors in there, but I'd love to hear you talk about one, kind of that mindset, that almost landlord by default approach. Mm-hmm. And what additional information you would look at. And yeah, maybe just kind of highlight that thought process. Am I on the right path here?
A little bit. So the 1% rule is meant to be a rule around selecting a home rather than a rule around retaining a home once you've already purchased it. And the reason why those two are separate considerations is if we take a step back and we look at the world of stock investing, it's very easy to say that if you wouldn't buy a stock right now, then don't hold it right now. If you wouldn't buy a share of Coca-Cola or Tesla or Marathon Oil today, then why would you hold that share? But we can say that in the world of stock investing because the transaction costs on a given share of Coca-Cola or Tesla or Marathon Oil is quite low. There are some apps in which you can trade for free or other platforms in which at worst, the trading cost is going to be $10, maybe $15. And so because transaction costs are so small, it's easy to apply that if you wouldn't buy, then don't hold framework into those types of assets. Now, with a home that you already own, transaction costs are fairly steep. In order to sell a home, the seller often, depending on how hot of a market it is and their ability to negotiate with a buyer, the seller often ends up paying the full real estate agent commission, which is usually around 6%, plus they often end up paying some additional closing costs. So let's say that it costs 7% of the value of the home in order to sell that home. What that means is you're taking a steep haircut when you sell a home. When you're making the decision as to whether to turn a home that you already own, a primary residence, into a rental property, I would go beyond simply applying the 1% rule to it, because that in and of itself wouldn't necessarily justify paying all of the transaction costs around selling that home. And in addition to that, there's also a little bit of, and this is more qualitative rather than quantitative, but there is a little bit of bird in the hand philosophy around it as well, in that if you are intimately familiar with a home, you can reasonably anticipate all of its major capital expenditures within the next 5 to 10 years. You have a very good sense of whether or not your water heater is going to need to be replaced in the next 5 years. You have a great sense of the windows and how soon they're going to need to be replaced, the flooring, the roof. You can anticipate your major expenses in that home in a way that you are less able to do in a home that is 2,000 miles away that you've only visited once. And so there is an intangible benefit to the familiarity and your ability to predict major upcoming expenses that come from a home that you've already lived in. And so when I'm evaluating whether or not my primary personal residence should be converted into a rental property upon move out, what I like to do is look at the cap rate. And in order to calculate the cap rate is short for capitalization rate. It is a measure of your unleveraged income stream from a property relative to the value of the asset. Now, what on earth does that mean? Here's what this means. Any asset makes money in two ways. One way is the appreciation of that asset. And the other way that that asset makes money is through its income stream. So a share of Coca-Cola makes money by paying a dividend, which is the income stream, and it makes money by hopefully appreciating in value over time. Same thing with a home. A home makes money in two ways. There is appreciation over time, and there's also the dividend or the income stream that that home pays. And so this formula, which is called cap rate, measures specifically the dividend payment of that home, assuming that that home is held free and clear. And the reason that we look at the home in the context of it being held free and clear, the reason that we look at cap rate as an unleveraged dividend is because we don't want to conflate financing with the asset itself. What I often tell people is, if you wouldn't buy something in cash, then don't buy it with a loan. So never rely on financing to justify a mediocre deal. And for that reason, it is wise to first evaluate the asset itself. And if that asset is worth buying, then you can look at financing arrangements. So when we pull financing out of the formula and we look purely at the performance of the home itself, what we want to do is we want to look at that dividend that it's going to pay out. And that is what the cap rate formula is. That's what I mean when I say that cap rate is the unleveraged dividend or the unleveraged income stream of the home relative to its value.
So give me an example here, like with this house that, let's just use this house that I was just describing. You have a $300,000 house and it's providing maybe $1,800 a month in rent. How would we, and yeah, so assuming that it's unleveraged, how would we calculate the cap rate on that?
Okay. So $1,800 per month times 12 months means that it would collect $21,600 in rent annually. And so that number is what's called your potential gross rent, which means it is potentially how much you could gross at full occupancy. But of course, your occupancy is never going to be 100%. So your next step is to subtract out the vacancies. Let's assume $21,600. We will assume that it is 95% occupied. So that means that after you subtract out the vacancies, your effective gross rent would be $20,520, assuming a 5% vacancy rate. Then you add in any other income that you could derive from this property. So for example, could you charge parking fees? Could you charge, if it was a duplex or a triplex, could you charge laundry fees? Could you have like a laundromat on site that all of the units could share and use and you would collect money from that? Do you have a small tool shed in the back and you could collect an additional $25 a month for storage? Would you charge pet fees? So you add in any of that other income to your effective gross rent. Let's just assume for the sake of example that that other income is, we'll say $480. So that puts you just at a flat $21,000 when you add that other income to your effective gross rent. So that $21,000 is now a figure that's known as your gross operating income. Now you take that gross operating income, and that is basically the gross income that you're collecting after you adjust for vacancies plus supplemental income. So that's what you're grossing. And then from that, you subtract out all of your operating overhead. And that includes your repairs, maintenance, major capital expenditures. When it comes to your mortgage, if you do have a mortgage, your mortgage consists of four properties: principal, interest, taxes, and insurance. You remove the principal and interest because that's the financing portion of your mortgage, but you do include the property taxes and the homeowner's insurance because that's operating overhead. Those will exist in perpetuity regardless of whether you have debt on this property or not. So you take all of that together is your operating overhead. You subtract that operating overhead from your gross operating income. What you're left with is a factor called net operating income. So it's your net income once you subtract your expenses from your gross. Then you take that net income and you divide it by the asset, by the value of the asset or the price that you paid for the asset. And what you're left with is the dividend that you're getting from that asset. So I was actually just going to calculate that for you, Jonathan.
Awesome. Yeah. So property taxes, let's just say property taxes run around $3,500 a year.
Let's just take a very, very simple, for the sake of simplicity, let's just assume that your total operating overhead is going to be $10,000 a year. I just made that number up. So you're grossing $21,000 minus $10,000 in operating overhead. So we'll say that your net operating income is $11,000. Your home, you purchased your home for $300,000. Then you divide that out and we are left with a 3.6% cap rate. So essentially, if you were to hold this home, then you would have a dividend or an income stream of about 3.6%. Now, remember, that's not your total return. That's just the dividend that that home is paying you. And as we outlined before, assets make money in two ways, the dividend and the appreciation. So if this home paid you a dividend of 3.6%, and conservatively, let's estimate that it keeps pace with inflation but no more, which is another 3%, then your total return on this property would be about 6.6%.
Yeah, that is awesome. Thank you. I mean, really, thank you so much for taking the time. I'm familiar with the term cap rate. I had never applied it to my specific situation. And so watching you go through that, that's something that I'm going to have to run that exercise a couple of times. But that's really useful, I would imagine, both for me at a selfish level, but also for people in our audience. I think that's actually shockingly, when I think about the people that we've talked to that have gotten involved with real estate, that a surprising number of landlords became landlords by default because they moved out of a home and they were trying to decide what to do with it. And when you go back to Brad's story and the belly flop of real estate experiences, you know, I think if you have a little bit of this knowledge on the front end, you can limit your downside and really go into this with all your ducks in a row and potentially turn something that you're sitting on either into a performing asset, or maybe you learn a lesson here and you can walk away from it. So thanks for taking the time to do that. Let me give this back to Brad because I know you have some follow-up thoughts.
Yeah, Paula, I'm curious if there's any shorthand for estimating the cap rate or really the expenses ultimately when you're looking at a property. I'm assuming there are many different categories you have to consider, like that people wouldn't necessarily back out just intuitively based on their limited knowledge of real estate, right? Like there's, they have to reserve for repairs. Like you talked about reserving for vacancies. I'm assuming you have to have some type of calculation for repairs and capital expenditures over years that might, I guess, get put into a couple of years, but you really need to spread that out and say, okay, this is how much I expect it to be year by year in essence, right? Like, can you talk through that? And is there any shorthand for someone if we're approaching a 1% rule based on the rental income? Are there any shorthand items for the expenses?
Absolutely. So an extreme shorthand, if you just want to do back of the envelope math, is that broadly speaking, approximately half of your gross rent is going to go towards operating overhead. Now, that's a very like painting with the broadest possible brush strokes, but it's useful for back of the envelope math. And it explains why the 1% rule is so commonly used among real estate investors. Because let's say that a property meets the 1% rule. If you're grossing 1% a month, then that's 12% per year. And if half of that is getting gobbled up by operating overhead, then that means that you're netting 6% per year. And if the property then keeps pace with inflation, but no more, that's another 3% for a total unleveraged return of 9%. And so that's the reason that the 1% rule is so commonly used among real estate investors, is that for many people, we set that as our minimum barometer when we're looking for the next property purchase.
So Paula, in that example, the cap rate would be 6%, again, based on this back of the envelope math, but because of the appreciation of roughly 3%. And again, that's not speculation. You're not banking on this thing exploding New York City or San Francisco style. This is just keeping up with inflation. So I know you said you don't like to consider appreciation, but it's fair to consider just that bare bones 3%. Is that roughly accurate?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So the national historic average is 5%. And so the National Association of Realtors loves to promote the 5% number. But I like to be a bit more conservative and only assume an inflationary increase and no more. I think it's better to make conservative projections, particularly where appreciation is involved. Because if you think of circle of influence, right, what is inside of your locus of control and what is not? Forced appreciation, which is appreciation that comes from renovations, sure, that's inside your locus of control. Improving your performance as a landlord, absolutely, it's inside your locus of control. Broad market forces outside of your control are outside of your control. There's nothing you can do about it. And so I think that it's unwise to make six-figure decisions based on that.
Paula, so we've been kind of talking about long-term buy and hold rentals. I know that this is something that you have cultivated this expertise on, but you have been in the real estate community for a while, and you've certainly been exposed to, you know, the different niches and strategies that people use. I'm curious, you know, long-term buy and hold versus the short-term that we hear now with like VRBO and Airbnb, these in particular. What are your thoughts on these approaches?
Ooh, so those are both fairly big topics, but when you think about Airbnb or VRBO or any type of short-term tenancy, in which you don't have a tenant, you have a guest who's staying there. Don't think of it as the real estate industry. Think of it as the hospitality industry. So it is unlike purchasing a commodity and then renting out that commodity in annual increments, which is what rental property investing is. Running an Airbnb, that is more akin to running a hotel or running a B&B, in that, number one, in terms of landlord-tenant law, none of that applies because you just have short-term guests. Number two, the responsibilities that you have in terms of providing consumables. You know, you have to provide dish soap, laundry detergent, paper towels, toilet paper, clean towels and bed sheets, all types of things that hotel owners are responsible for, but that landlords are not. Number three, you have increased turnover, and oftentimes, depending on location and price point, you may have higher vacancy rates, which affect the way in which you calculate the projected returns on that investment. And number four, and this is something that is a risk for Airbnb and VRBO hosts that is not a risk for hotels, you also hold the risk that the city could change its laws at any time, and all of a sudden you won't be allowed to rent out this property as a short-term rental. Given all of those risk factors, number one, what that points to is that Airbnb being a property is so intrinsically different from being a landlord that they should not be considered the same industry. One is the hospitality industry and the other is the real estate industry. Number two, what I often tell people is that if you are considering purchasing a property for the sake of Airbnb-ing it, make sure that that property passes muster as a long-term rental. And then if you think that you can make additional money from it by using it as a short-term rental, that's icing on the cake. That's great. But at a minimum, you have a plan B, you have multiple exit strategies. And if you decide that you don't want the active responsibility of managing frequent turnovers, you don't want the responsibility of running a hotel, or if city council passes a law next Tuesday outlawing Airbnbs in your municipality, you can at least convert it into a 12-month rental. Because the worst situation to be in, the situation that you absolutely want to avoid, is purchasing a property that in which the numbers only make sense if it's a short-term rental, the city council changes its codes, and all of a sudden you're stuck and you can't rent it out long-term because that rent is barely going to cover the mortgage. That would be the absolute worst-case scenario. And that worst-case scenario comes about when people don't have multiple exit strategies.
Yeah, Paula, that was an amazing explanation. And I love how you look at these short-term rentals and say, still apply those same formulas, right? You're looking at the 1% rule, the cap rate, all these things. So yeah, that is a great shorthand for me personally. I love that. And now I'm curious, you've owned single family rentals for years now. And I'd love to hear your thought process on when, if ever, you would consider selling those. Are there fundamentals that change that might lead you down that path? Is it like, how do you even approach that mentally? Is this akin to looking at a stock and saying, okay, the ownership changed and I just don't believe in this anymore? Do you look at, hey, this was a Class B neighborhood and now it's a Class D, I think it's time to sell? How do you keep on top of that? And what do you consider when even contemplating selling?
First of all, for any person who is listening, who's trying to apply that question to their own life, the first question that I would ask is, what is your goal? Is your goal to achieve the highest possible returns, or is your goal to build a stream of passive income that leads to financial independence? Given that they're listening to the Choose FI podcast, I'm betting that the majority of people who are listening to this, the goal is financial independence, as is mine with my real estate strategy. And so when I look at my portfolio of properties, I am not necessarily concerned with playing Monopoly. I'm not necessarily concerned with constantly elevating to higher and higher levels of returns. I simply want enough money from my rental properties that I am financially independent, and that's it. And once I achieve that, I'm done. And at that point, I'm ready to leave good enough alone. In terms of selling properties, unless there is something, some element of the neighborhood that dramatically changes, if a neighborhood falls from Class B to Class D, okay, that would get me to sell. But if I simply wanted to make better use of the cash that I have tied up in that property, I would far rather take out a cash out refinance against that property than I would sell it. Because with selling, you have transaction costs, and then you have a load of cash that you then need to decide what to do with. There doesn't really seem to be, assuming that the condition of the property and the condition of the neighborhood is similar to what I expected it to be at the time that I bought it, you know, assuming that I bought it in a Class B neighborhood and it's still a Class B neighborhood, then there's no reason to let go of that purchase when I could just take out a cash out refinance, pull $70,000 or $80,000 or $100,000 out of that property, and then use that money to make another investment if I were to so choose to do that. Alternately, if the goal is financial independence, then the alternate goal is just pay off the properties and live on the cash flow.
Paula, I've really appreciated the depth that you've been able to go into with the content in this particular episode. You know, Brad and Ed, who works with us here at ChooseFI, Brad and Ed are thinking about doing a turnkey experiment just to see what it would look like to basically be able to outsource their brain. And they're kind of, I think they're going to kind of have different approaches on this, but I was curious, would you be willing to come back on the show for a second episode and kind of talk to us about Yeah, just kind of help us build a framework for sifting through the type of turnkey operations that are out there, how to think about this in general?
Absolutely. The phrase outsource your brain raises an instant red flag. So I'll come back on.
That's awesome. Brad, how do you feel about outsourcing your brain? I don't know. I'm skeptical.
I don't know. I'll pay somebody to feel something about that for me.
Can I outsource my feelings? That's fantastic. We would love to have you on. Now, real quick for our audience, you have started this past year a real estate investing course. I know that people in our community, like, first of all, there's very few courses out there that we just jump over the moon for because we get so excited about them. And I mean, I think our audience can appreciate, based on the level of detail that you went in this episode, there's so much to learn. You would be a fantastic spokesperson for this. How can somebody find out more information about your course in real estate?
Well, thank you for asking. So I'm a bit of a slacker and I do not yet have an official sales page, but I do have a free ebook about real estate investing. It's called 7 Expensive Rental Property Mistakes to Avoid, and you can download it for free at affordanything.com/real estate. When you do that, you'll join an email newsletter, an email list essentially. And in that email list, I share more information about rental property investing and real estate investing. Currently, I'm working with the first group of students who are in the course. When we relaunch the course, which will be September 23rd through September 27th, 2019, I will announce that first to all of the people who have downloaded the free ebook. So just download the free ebook, and that is how people can get more information. Again, that's affordanything.com/real estate.
Awesome. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me on.
You know, it's so funny, Brad. I remember Paula Pant being one of the early guests on the Bigger Pockets podcast. At that time, I think she had relatively recently started her real estate journey. And to see how far she has come with this, how much she's broadened her knowledge base on real estate, going from someone that was just willing to try something to someone who has truly become an expert. It was exciting to give her the floor and just listen to her framework that she uses and why she gets so excited about single family rentals. To our audience, if you got value from today's episode, and if you've been getting value from the episodes up to this point, just take 1 second, press the subscribe button on the platform you're listening to this on. Just let the providers know you're getting value from the show and you want to be here when we produce additional content. If you want to support us and what we're doing here at Choosify, here are 4 easy ways. 1, leave us an iTunes review. To do that, just go to choosify.com/iTunes. 2, use our page to sign up for travel credit cards. If you want to travel the world with miles and points instead of your hard-earned dollars, then just go to choosify.com/cards and get started today. 3, if you're working on the milestones of FI, set up a personal capital account to track your progress and use our affiliate link. It's completely free, and just go to choosify.com/PC. P as in Paul, C as in cat. And 4, and most importantly, find your friends, coworkers, and family members who might be open to this message and tell them about the podcast. Have them start with episode 100. It is a fantastic starting place. All right, my friends, the fire is spreading. We'll see you next time as we continue to go down the road less traveled.
You've been listening to Choose FI Radio Podcast, where we help middle-class America build wealth one life hack at a time.